you hadn't wrecked your knee chasing Sam Jones that night, would you have pursued an NBA career as opposed to baseball?
I really don't think so. I was not a real good professional basketball player. I realized having being there means you have some talent, and I did. I had some talent, but not the talent that was going to come into the league or was at that time. I was not a starter. I would have been a guy who was on the verge of being cut each year. At that point, you know, by being a 6'6", 185-pound white guy, who I could run pretty good. I jumped fairly well, and I was a pretty good shooter, but I just wasn't built to be an underneath man to rebound in the NBA. And I was in danger of being cut that year. You know, as a matter of fact, almost was. I was on the bubble. And even though I was in the minor leagues in baseball, I knew that if I had a future, it had to be in baseball. And I probably wouldn't have lasted more than another year at that anyway. It was fine. But at that time, I signed as a second-round draft pick for $7,500. And we played in the finals that first year. The Celtics beat us in the championship. So the next year, I got a $1,000 raise, all the way up to $8,500. So it wasn't something I was going to make a whole lot of money in, you know. But I wouldn't have been a star in the NBA.
Baylor was something that night, wasn't he?
Oh. Yeah, well, that's how I got hurt. Elgin was on his way to a record, and Boston was running the 24-second clock down each time, you know, so we started fouling. And as I started to foul Sam Jones, he decided to break to go a different direction, and our knees collided. And actually, mine hurt really badly, but I played the next week, and he was almost out, you know. He was running around limping, and I was running. And about after that, then when the torn cartilage started to take effect at that point, then I was out for the rest of the year. So he came out better than I did.
Did the knee problems affect your pitching?
It did that following summer. I had pretty good. I was 14-10, I believe, with Mobile. I went to Double A ball, and I walked the same number of people I struck out that year. I had a low strikeout total, but a high walk total. I think it was 79 strikeouts and 79 walks. And I had the only time in my life in the big leagues that I pitched any amount of innings that I had over a 3-something or a run average. My run average was 4 that year with a lot of innings. And the knee bothered me on the follow-through, since it was my front knee, the one that I put all the weight on each time I threw. And I didn't realize I was doing it. And I had my first sore arm that year for a game or two. So it bothered me at that point. But after that, no, it did bother me.
At what point did you realize that your fastball wasn't going to take you to the majors?
Well, I never did think that I had a bad fastball until Ralph Houck convinced me that I did not have a great fastball. A few hitters convinced me of that also. I knew probably in A-ball, the third year that I played, or second year that I played baseball in Reading, Pennsylvania, that my fastball was not going to be the pitch. I really honed breaking pitch that year, slider, where I struck a lot of people out on. It was a good little slider that I had. And I really rode that to the big leagues along with the sinker ball. The way I got to the big leagues was in 1961, they were cutting me off of the squad at Cleveland after my wife was already on her way to Cleveland. It was the last day, and Dick Stigman, a pitcher we had hurt his arm. He didn't have any left-handed pitching. And they called me in and informed me I was going back to the minors. And I knew at that point that maybe I didn't have a future in baseball, because they needed a pitcher, and I was going to finish my master's degree this year at Morehead that winter. So I called Gabe Paul and said, I'm going to go pitch this summer, and if I don't get to the big leagues, then I'm quitting. It's not a threat or anything, it's just a statement, because I will finish my master's degree, I'll go into teaching and coaching, and if you can get anything out of me by trading me to get someone, you know, to come in, then that's great. And he was very good. 2 weeks later, I got traded. But what I did at that same time was I said, I'm going to start seeing how far everybody can hit balls off of me. I'm going to throw the ball right down the middle of the plate. Some phenomenon happened, and I couldn't recapture it after that year. I don't know what happened. I had the best sinker ball that possible. I was relaxed, throwing the ball at about 3/4 speed, right down the middle. And in the batting practice, I noticed these guys aren't hitting this, but everybody's hitting ground ball, ground ball, ground ball. And when I throw BP, that's all they hit, were ground balls. So I started pitching that way. I pitched 2 shutouts in the first 2 games, and I got to the big ones. And then I started trying to throw hard again when I got there. You know, I said, oh, I got to quit this. I'm up here now with all these good guys. I still had a good sinker ball that year, but I never had the sinker again that I had then, which makes me realize that how much control your mind and your attitude has over your performance. I didn't really have anything to lose at that point. You know, I'm going to go ahead and play. Still had to break and pitch, but I started throwing a really easy sinker ball and one ground ball after another. It was amazing. And I just sat back and laughed. Boy, that's easy. But I didn't have a good fastball, and I really spotted it. I would not let anybody hit my fastball. In other words, if they hit it, it was going to be in a good place. And I had good control. And that's how I got there, by throwing all breaking pitches and occasionally spotting the fastball.
Your stuff and your temperament seemed more suited to the bullpen, as it turned out.
It did.
Were you forced into the bullpen?
Pretty much.
And it just worked out that
way. Well, when the Yankees traded for the year with Washington, I started some games, but then I was in the bullpen quite a bit at that point. I always thought I was a starter. I didn't relieve in the minor leagues only two or three times that I ever pitched in relief. And so when I came up, when I got traded to the Yankees, the first outing I had was in relief, and I gave up a hit that cost us a ball game in California. The very next night, they brought me back in the exact same situation. What I did the first night was I walked the left-hander, and then the right-hander got a base hit, and they scored the winning run. Next night, Hal brought me right back in. Same situation. I struck the left-handed guy out. So at that point, then I pitched a game, another game, got my first win for them in Detroit, and threw well. Then I was on, when I really thought I had it made, I came in the first inning in Baltimore, two outs, relieved Bill Stafford, who was having a bad inning, the base were loaded or something, Boog Powell was hitting, I struck him out. Went on to finish that game, eight and one-third innings, I had 11 strikeouts, no walks, two base hits, didn't give up a run, hit a triple with two men on. You know, it's when Dizzy Dean Pee Wee Reese did that. Hey, I starred that day. That was my very best day. And I thought, now I'm going to get a chance to start. You know, nah, back in the bullpen. And Hauk had a good theory, and I never believed him for a long time, then I finally told him he was correct. Being tall and with somewhat of a big, loose, gawky motion that I had, it was deceptive the first time people hit off of me. Second time around, he felt they started zeroing in on me a little bit. And he probably was correct. I would rather have been a starter, obviously. Relief pitchers were not paid like they are now, nor was there even the same importance placed on relief pitching as there is today. And the last game I started, he had to start me in Cleveland. I remember it. We had a lot of people hurt. I think it was 1968. And he flew Fred Talbot and I back from California because we were playing there, and we had a game the next night in Cleveland. So he flew us back early, which in the meantime, you lay there and you can't go to sleep all night. And then your roommate finally comes in from the trip where they flew in, and then you go to bed. You go to sleep. But I started the second game, the doubleheader, to a shutout. Threw 101 pitches, gave up five hits, no walks, three strikeouts, two double plays, and I only faced 30 men.
Wow.
And it was a good game. My last start in Cleveland, you know, and so back to the bullpen again. I said, does this mean I'm back in the bullpen? He says, yeah. But it was fine. I enjoyed how he was the best manager I ever played for. And he made you feel differently, you know, feel good about it. I played for some good teams after that. The Giants in 71 were a good team. That was a good ball club. And the Cubs had a lot of good players but didn't have a good attitude about winning the pennant. They had some good players.
What was it like playing for DeRocher?
DeRocher was a very difficult man to play for me. He still had the old idea that a relief pitcher was someone who wasn't good enough to be a starter. And we struggled a little bit. Then he was out of there about two-thirds of the season when Whitey Logney came in. But DeRocher he didn't talk to us much. I didn't really know him very well. Obviously, he was a very good baseball man throughout the years, but late in his career, he wasn't, in my opinion, you know, from the time that I spent with him, which is probably unfair to him because other people were with him for a long time.
What influence did Johnny Sain have?
Johnny Sain had a lot to do with creating a positive mental attitude with me. He taught me a lot about how I coach right now, or how I did when I coached, how I handle players. He and Ralph Houck were both excellent. To have them both on the same team was was really a godsend for me wanting to be a coach. Mm-hmm. But Sane would find out an interest you had, which would be a common point between us. We'd talk about that. Then when we talked about pitching, he always never told you, here's what you should do. He would talk around with options and things, and pretty soon you'd say, it's my idea that I do this. And it wasn't. He had planted that seed to make me think it was my idea, which means that I'm going to do it much better than if he said, here's what you should do, then I'm going to try it for a while. If it doesn't work, but if I think this is right, and I brought it up, then I'm going to do it well. And I tried to do that with players a lot, not say, here's what you should do, but we'd talk about the several things, and then pretty soon that player would say, here's what I think I should be doing. And you've done it. And it works better.
Great teaching technique.
And Johnny did that. He was good. He was good at getting in your head and making you have a good positive attitude. If someone gets a hit off of you, they're lucky. You know, hey, and that's over with. What's happened? You know, you go get the next one. And he taught me a lot of good things.
What was it like on the Yankees when things turned sour? They went from perennial winners to the bottom of the standings.
Very bad.
Shocking?
Yeah.
Were people in shock?
No, not necessarily shock. We had a lot of things happen to us. CBS bought the Yankees. Mike Burke who was our president at that time. Wasn't really a general manager, but he was CBS's man in charge of the Yankees. He was a great man. And Mike Burke was a very intelligent man, had a lot of good things about him. He didn't know a lot about baseball, but he attempted to learn. And he would listen to people. But the Yankee organization was going down the tube at that time. They did a lot of things to the farm system, got rid of some scouts, and really ran it at a bare-bones type operation. It was really a financial deal for them with the amortization, the tax write-offs, and whatever. And they only kept them for 4 or 5 years, I can remember now, and then sold us. But during that time, Kubek got hurt in 64. We lost a shortstop. Not to say bad things about Phil Wentz or Ruben Amaro or anybody else that we had playing shortstop, but Tony Kubek was really the leader of the team. We can talk about all the other people that were on that team, the Mantles and Maris and all those guys, but Kubek was the leader. And we lost him. And when you lose a shortstop, it really hurts your team a lot, particularly one who has leadership capabilities. Roger Maris didn't play a whole lot more. He didn't like New York much. Bobby Richardson retired. Elston Howard was traded and was getting old. And, you know, there were a lot of things happening at that point. And they found out that Tom Tresh, without Mantle and Maris around him, was not quite the same hitter. He didn't get fastballs anymore. He got breaking pitches and all speed stuff, which he had a hard time hitting.
And the farm system stopped producing.
Farm system was really bad. One of the biggest shocks that I had was I went to the White Sox at the end of the year in a waiver deal. I was playing in 1970. I was only there for a month. Went to spring training, most of spring training with them in 1971, then was traded to the Giants. When I went to the Giants, they hadn't broken. They still had some of their minor leaguers and prospects there. So basically, I was going from the Yankees to the Giants. When I saw the prospects they had there, I mean, the people they sent out, like Maddox and Matthews and those guys,
right.
I mean, and they sent them out. They're not even going with us. And they're better than anything we got, you know, with the Yankees. And I don't mean to say bad things about the kids that they had or that they brought up, but our first-round choices were never successful. The kids that were in spring training in minor league were not really competitive with the rest of the league. And things got sad. And then they didn't get well again, until Clyde Clutch was hired by the Yankees several years later. As a farm director. And then they started rebuilding the farm system. And it went down the tube. And it was bad. Front office people were cut down a little bit, you know, and it was bad. I'll tell you what hurt me worse as a player than anything else, if people weren't booing us anymore, you know, on the road. And we got used to when we were good,
feared.
We'd go out and people would boo, you know, the Yankees, the dreaded Yankees, you know, were in. Now it wasn't anymore. They didn't cheer every now and then, you know, when we did something well. And they never did that in the past. So you knew then it was sympathy. And you didn't like that. You liked it better when they were 100% against you because you knew you were good. And I had experienced bad teams before. before. I'd come over from the Senators, you know, to the Yankees, so I knew what losing was like. And then to experience those two really good years and then start the fall, I mean, we were coming back up again by 1970 when I left the Yankees. But it was a very bad feeling.
Were you expecting the Yankees to cut you loose?
No, not really. Had I owned a home in New Jersey where I was living, I would have gone in with Kirk Ludd on the antitrust suit. Here's what happened on that one. I'd been on waivers apparently earlier in the year, which they do sometimes throw it out to see what kind of interest. I was approaching 37 years of age, which is getting pretty old. They had some kids who were going to have to protect the next year. There's a good possibility I wouldn't be protected on 40-man roster. My efficiency, I guess, was going down a little bit at that time in their mind. The Mets were in a pennant race that year, and the Mets were interested in acquiring me to go over there. I wanted to go to them. I could stay where I was and still go play, you know. But I had to go through waivers. I had to clear waivers at that time of the year. No trades or anything. In order to go, I'd have to go through waivers. And normally, that's you just do it. Well, the first team that had a shot at me was the last place team in the American League, which happened to be the White Sox. Okay? Suddenly, Ralph Howe comes into me, and we're in Baltimore, and he says, you're going to be traded. You're going, I'm sorry, Sammy, so I don't know how it happened, but you're going to the White Sox. That's what happened to the Mets. He said, because he'd already told me that there was a possibility of going to the Mets. I said, fine, no problem. So it was one of those deals where they had claimed me. Irrevocable claim. And the next spring, when I go to spring training with the White Sox, they have a young player that they got from the Cubs. The Cubs had sold him, and he was a prospect. The Cubs were fighting with the Mets that year. They were in a pennant drive. The Mets, the Cubs, and somebody else.
They just wanted to keep you away from the Mets.
That's right. That's exactly because White Sox didn't want me. I go over there, they're losing 106 ball games. And the next spring, I wasn't in their plans. I mean, I knew that from being there. They were going to rebuild. Chuck Tanner, who's a great manager, you know, he didn't even have to say anything to me. But when I go over there and see this young player from the Cubs, another left-handed pitcher, and me knowing probably, so I got traded, you know, in spring training. And it was a set-up deal as far as I was concerned. And one that they sort of got together on, you know, we'll give you a player, you keep him from going over there. They thought, you know, maybe I could help him defend.
Or boondoggle.
I can't prove that. But I know that that happened. And I would have pitched a real bitch, but I didn't own a home in there. In New Jersey, my family was, I had already gone back.
Where were you living in Jersey?
I was living at the time with Jay Gibbs over in Ridgewood.
Yeah. I grew up in Oregon.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yankees
yeah.
lives in the area.
That's right. We stayed in those areas over
Louis
there.
Louis Kuhn's hometown.
Yeah. Big Louis. Louis was around the state about 3 weeks ago, shilling for a team in Lexington.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But it was it was a bad. But anyway, when I went over there, the spring trainings were different. The White Sox team had some decent prospects, more than the Yankees did. And, then going on to the Giants was really an idol. They had some talent.
Sure. Really, yeah.
Good team.
And you got a chance to pitch in the postseason one more time.
Mm-hmm. One more time. And it would have been nice to win that. The Pirates went ahead and beat us and went on and beat Baltimore in the series. And the Pirates were a good team. They were good. We thought we had a chance to beat them. But, Gaylord had a bad game. One of the games. It was 3 out of 5 at that time.
Did getting shuttled to 3 different teams in less than 2 years hasten your retirement?
Yeah. I just
didn't want any more of it.
Yeah, right. I think I lost a little enthusiasm for it, particularly with the Cubs. When I went over there that year, I went stretches like 20 days in a row without throwing, you know, in a game. And to give you one little clue about Leo, I went to Larry, pitching coach. Larry Jansen, who happened to be the pitching coach. And he'd been my pitching coach with the Giants year before. Now he's with the Cubs. And he was responsible for me going to the Cubs because he told them, because I had a great year in 71. I had a good year. And I get released at the end of the year. I get a call one night, like 12 o'clock at night, from Charlie Fox, and about 3/4. The Giants were inebriated a lot. Their their management thought they drank a lot. But anyway.
Because of stuff.
And at that time, I had talked with the Arizona, University of Arizona. They had contacted me and wanted to talk to me about taking the head baseball job there. And I went down and interviewed with them. And so Charlie said, we're assuming, are you going to take that job? I said, well, it's offered to me. He said, well, we're going over rosters and stuff, and we're going to release you. I said, fine. It's too cold to play out there anyway. I mean, you got to be out of your mind when I'm playing Candlestick another year. So I went down. Anyway, I didn't get the job. Then I get a call from the Cubs. Come in. I would play for them. And I said, fine. You know, I didn't have anybody else to play for at that time. And at 38, a lot of people aren't interested in signing you. And they thought they had a good shot at it. And that's when you hook on with a team like that. So I played with them that year. And then two times that year, one time we were in St. Louis. And I went to Larry Jansen and said, you know, Larry, I hadn't thrown forever. Can I throw batting practice tonight? You know, I need facing hitters. So I went out and threw about 20 minutes of batting practice. And we're sitting there, about sixth inning, we get a call from Leo. Me. What? So I get up, loosen up, and go in the game. I don't have anything, you know, very much, because I've already thrown 20 minutes about 2 hours earlier. And so I go in and get him out. And so we go like 15, 20 more days, and I go to Larry and say, Larry, I need to throw BP again, but if I throw tonight, will he call me to put me in the game? He said, no. I throw BP again. I can't remember where it was. I'm up again throwing in the game, and I didn't do well that time. And, you know, two or three things like that. And that's,
did it deliberately to mess with your head?
I don't know whether it was deliberate or not. And at that point, I just didn't, I'd lost a little enthusiasm for playing. And I was away from home. Family, although they lived there when school started, they were only there like 3 months. And I just got tired of the traveling and being away, so.
Yeah. You'd been coaching basketball for a number of years by then.
Yeah, I had come back here each year in the off season. And, well, I did basketball for like 4 years or 5 years at the time when I was playing. And then the basketball coach that I played for, who was a basketball coach at that time, resigned and then, you know, became just athletic director. And at that point, I asked him, the president, said, can I work with baseball, you know, get out of basketball? So I'd come back and work with the baseball team in the fall and then some of their winter conditioning and a little bit in the spring before I left. And it worked out well. But I did. I'd come back here and work each year. It wasn't a lot of money, but it was just being involved in it.
Have you been here more or less ever since your retirement?
Yeah, basically. The first year after retirement, I worked for an insurance company here in town. I didn't work for the university. Wait a minute, was that the first year? Yeah. And then the second year, I went off to, went back to coach with the Tigers with Hauk in 1975. I went up and was pitching coach that year. At the end of that year, I said, I'm not making any money at all. I mean, coaching's making nothing. Plus, here I am on the road again. You know, I've already done this thing. So I came back here, then they offered me a baseball job. So I took that and was very happy with it.
It's a fortunate man who can come back to his alma mater.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to do that, but it's worked out well for me.
Your studies in sociology and your education in general, how did that make your attitude towards sports and athletes different from most of the men you played with?
Oh, I don't know that made me any more introspective about athletics than anybody else. Played with some very smart guys who'd never gone to college, you know, or had good ideas about it. I think I understood, particularly not being a star, being on the Yankees when I first went there was really an experience. I found myself just sitting and looking at Mantle and Yogi Berra and all these people I've been watching on TVs all this time. Also understood the pressures that they were under from the public, from the scrutiny, the whole bit that I didn't have. And also understood that it was a business, that it would end, you know, that I needed something when it was over. Nowadays you make enough money if you're a big star that you're secure financially. I don't know how secure you are mentally the rest of your life, but you're secure financially. But being with sociology only, I think that plus my nature anyway helped me get along with almost every type of person. Very few people that I couldn't find some sort of common ground or that we could discuss things or talk about, even mountains. consider me a friend, you know. And to do that, you got to be pretty sharp. But I don't know that it was a great help. I think primarily being involved with higher education was good for me. I got my first good feeling about that when I played basketball. All the basketball guys had been to college. At the time I started in baseball, very few of the baseball players had even been, much less had a degree. And I found out that a degree from Morehead State, or what I knew, I was in good shape with all those other guys who come from the Big Ten. We had an Ivy Leaguer, Rudy La Russa, when I played with
Dartmouth.
La Russa, yeah, from Dartmouth. And then later on in baseball, I'd get with the Senators, and we had another guy from Dartmouth.
Broberg.
No. Dang it, left-handed pitcher. Good guy. I really like him a lot. Super guy. And I remember. But anyway, he was
Burnside.
Pete Burnside. Good call. Good job. And Pete and I were good friends. You know, he was the only Dartmouth guy I ever saw that chewed tobacco.
Really?
But on education is what you make out of it. Sociology, I don't know if it helped me a lot. I wasn't a great sociology student. It was a dual major in sociology and economics.
I talked to Jim Bowden.
Did you?
Last week. I had a very good talk with him. And he said that he had good things to say about you.
He felt
he would have brought intelligence to the role of player rep, and you brought intelligence and diplomacy, which he lacked, the ingredient he lacked.
Yeah, he was not a diplomatic person. We had a running argument for like 2 years. We would discuss religion. He wanted to argue, but we'd discuss it. Then the gun control issue, you know, I do a lot of target shooting and hunting in this area down here. The crime is non-existent, I mean, you know, whatever. And so he argued. We discussed that situation for like 2 years.
I read something you wrote on that subject.
Really?
I saw it in your file somewhere.
I'll be darned. Well, a couple of times I had written letters to the editors, and I quit doing that because I wrote a letter to the editor one time, and I thought it was a well-phrased letter. It was good. And I even went back and reread the letter. I got some stuff, even worse than John Birch Society, sent to me. I mean, it was really white supremacist crap. You know, and I said, what? And I went back and read my letter. I said, what did I say that would make these people send this stuff to me? So I quit writing letters to the editor. I said, if I'm doing this and I'm going to get this kind of mail, forget it. You know, that's not what I'm trying to do. But Jim, I would talk with Jim. A lot of people didn't even want to talk to him. You know, he was a little bit radical. He was a very liberal person. You know, one time Bob Friend told him, Friend was playing cards and Bowden was trying to talk with him. Friend finally said, we had him for 1 year, he took his cigar out and said, Bowden, get the blank away from here. He said, oh, you are the damn communist. You know, and then Jim left, and one time Roger Maris told him, get out of right field or he would kick his ass right there in front of everybody in the stadium. And he left. But Jim was outspoken. Matter of fact, had a lot of ideas at that time that were a little bit revolutionary, but came to pass in the Players Association.
Right. Mm-hmm. Raising the minimum salary, for one.
Yes. Did a lot. And about knowing salaries, everybody knowing what everybody else made, and these are negotiating in the beginning. Everybody said, wow, I'm not going to tell what I make. So Jim had some good ideas, some that were not good, but a lot of them actually came to pass.
Why do many athletes mistrust intellectuals?
Do you think they still do as much as they did earlier? Is that...
No, I don't think so, because I think more of them are educated, at least the baseball players, more of them have gone to college now than your generation.
Well, number one, I don't consider myself an intellectual. I chewed tobacco, I was tall, I've not been overly controversial, had a few problems with. I personally would probably be more disarming to people than someone who really was a so-called atheist by degrees. And when you can think about intellectuals, sometimes you think someone is condescending to you, which is not true. But, there's been, oh, you're a college boy. You know, in the beginning, guys would call me professor and all that stuff. And now, you know, now there's a lot of people often have degrees, so I don't know if there's a basic mistrust. I think you, with certain people, you would have to win their confidence, if that's what you're about. I don't know if the confidence is the right word, respect, or be allowed to get in that circle, which is what I miss more than anything else about not playing ball anymore. Every time I went back to another old timers game up at Blue Ash in Cincinnati, they had earlier the old Crawford Field that they rebuilt the outfield fence. And, yeah. Yeah, and they have an old timers game each year to raise money for some charity. And I went back this year, and it was probably, and I've been to old timers in Yankee Stadium this year, the one at Cincinnati was long. And it was like you're back into that. I've seen Gary Bell that I hadn't seen for a long time. I played with Cleveland and Dick Raddatz and, you know, and a lot of these guys that I don't see when I go back to the Yankees. And you get back into that old kidding each other, you know, and the stuff that you do. And I miss, that's the one thing that I probably miss about baseball. Because you're part of a really an elite group that nobody else can get in. And it's, you have that bond. If you play, I had a bond to Bob Will that was there. Because I played baseball in the major league. He did too. It's a bond that you kind of have. I know that's way off your intellectual question, but
it's all right.
But it's something you can't buy. You have to, you know, you earn it, I guess.
That's tough.
I'll answer that.
That's let's get into the Players Association.
Okay.
You became the Yankees player rep, I take it, after Cleet Boyer was traded? Is that
correct?
Did you seek the job? Did somebody say, let Steve do it?
Elston Howard came to me, and I said, why don't you do this job? I had been the alternate at Washington the first year. I can't remember who our player rep was, but I was elected as an alternate. So when Cleet left, and Elston Howard came and said, I want you. I think primarily, not that he thought I could do a great job, but I think they wanted me more than they did Bout. And I always felt like that first vote was a backlash against Jim rather than a vote for me. And I said, I don't know whether I want to do it or not. When he came, I said, and I even told him that. I said, Ellie, if you want me to do it, fine, but I don't want to do it as someone who is an alternative to Jim Bout. So Jim campaigned. I did not. You know, Elston nominated me. I think Jim had gone around to people and tried to campaign, which probably hurt him more than helped him. But I did not campaign for the job at all, and ended up getting elected as player rep. And at that time, not a lot of people wanted to be player rep. You got to understand that. None of the big salary guys were player rep at that time. It was always somebody who was expendable, because you knew you were going to get traded or zapped somewhere along the line.
A lot of relief pitchers.
Mm-hmm. I guess so. We were probably the most expendable of anybody.
Seems like a third of the guys I've interviewed are relief pitchers.
Oh, gosh. Well, that means we're smarter than us. Left-handers are smarter, right-handers.
Well, Bouton had the notion that relief pitchers were sitting around a lot of the time and not active, and they had time to think and organize.
Yeah, you think about a lot of things, mostly sex, while you're sitting out there. But no, you do have a lot of time. I'll admit that. But what really happened, seriously, was that the guys in the upper salary range and the guys who were more, other than Butch Robinson, one of the few, I think, he was a player rep. Jim Bunning has always been somewhat never afraid to rock the boat or anything, but he also had great stature. You know, they weren't going to trade him because he's a player rep. Some of the other people, they really insinuated to you that, hey, you know, better back off some of this stuff or you'll be out of here. And nobody wanted to leave the Yankees in those days. But, hey, you know, I decided to go ahead and do it. And the Yankees treated me very well. Lee McPhail got along very well with Lee. As a matter of fact, they even gave me, the Yankees did, this was a little thing they tried to do, I think, to butter me up a little bit. Gave me a private room on the road when everybody else had roommates, you know, except Mantle and some of the others. Well, I got a private room because I was a player rep. Then we started getting serious when Marvin Miller came in, and we started really wanting to do things other than improve bullpens or showers, you know, in the ballparks and stuff like that to get down to real issues. Then I no longer had a private room. I had to go back to room.
Really?
Yeah. and that was the only thing. But other than that, I never received pressure from management. Some people did. Yeah. He's gone to lunch. He'll be back at 1 o'clock, about 15 minutes. What's it for?
I have no idea. No plan to put me down with it.
Okay.
I don't
want to
walk in.
Thank you.
Okay.
Where was
that? You were in a semi-private room.
Oh. Yeah. But being player rep was, there's a certain amount of ego involved with that. I didn't like to fly, so it wasn't, I wanted to go a lot of places. We had a lot of negotiation where I'd leave Morehead at 4 o'clock in the morning, fly to New York, get back at 2 o'clock at night. Some of those things, which weren't fun, but we were doing a lot of things at that time that required us meeting.
When did you become the American League rep?
Came the American League rep, when was I? Yankees, 66? Somewhere in that time. 67, I think. I became the American League rep in 68. Last year.
You were the American League rep until you left the league, right? So 3 years, okay. That's one thing I haven't been able to think of. When I talked to Martin Miller, he couldn't remember when you and Buck Rogers dovetailed there.
Yeah, Martin, I left in 70, at the end of 70 season.
How did you become the league rep? Is that a vote of the player reps? Or?
The player reps from the league vote on two people. They vote on a representative for the whole group, and then they vote on a pension representative. They nominated and voted for me for the American League representative, which to me I felt like was one of the better honors I ever had, you know, from my own contemporary, the other, representative. And I appreciate that a lot. That was a great honor.
I talked to the pension rep last week, Dick Hall.
Oh, yeah. Turkey.
Probably the only Swarthmore man to eat a grasshopper.
Oh, he's still laughing. I mean, Swarthmore, they got a team, and that a girls' school. You know, we get on him all the time. But he was a sharp guy.
Yes. When did you meet Marvin Miller?
Met Marvin for the first time when he came to spring training to talk to all of us. The year that he was, he sort of campaigning for his job.
66.
Yeah. And it was funny, you know, because here's a guy who's actually got a campaign for his job, so to speak. But anyway, Marvin came around. Marvin is not impressive when you look at him. You know, here comes a guy in that looks a little slick with the mustache and everything. He's got the bad arm and the whole bit. And I heard him talk and really liked what he had to say and the way he delivered it. Voted for him in a second. There was a lot of resistance to Marvin from some players and from all the management. You're getting a union guy in here, you know, and hey, he's going to ruin baseball and whatever, and I voted for him. We had head judge Cannon before, who said apple pie, motherhood, and baseball, you know, and we did nothing. I did lose my car at that time. We had been getting, I got a car for a couple of years till Marvin came in also from Chrysler, and that was through Judge Cannon. Player rep got a Chrysler Corporation car, so I had a station wagon for 2 years for free driving.
Well, now, when were you player?
That was the first 2 years till Marvin came in.
Oh, you were player rep back then?
Yeah, right before Marvin came in, and for the first year. Mm-hmm. Then when Cannon left, or was no longer hired, and then Chrysler, I think, dropped that deal. Which is okay. Yeah, me a car. It was a nice little perk for a while. And that's one thing Bowden said, if I'm player rep, I will not use the car. I will let people who don't have cars use it, you know, and whatever. That was good. I said, I'll use the car. Yeah, here, I'm going to drive that car. And then Marvin talked to us. Of course, Cleet was the player rep at that time. And then when we had meetings, I was very impressed with him. And then probably the most, I know Hal would get pissed off to hear me say this, but Marvin Miller is probably the man I respected most of anybody I knew in baseball. And I knew after being with him for a while in negotiations, he was not going to kill baseball. He wasn't going to do anything to hurt baseball. A lot of people said, hey, if you guys continue the way you are, you're going to kill baseball. The old-timers come in and said, you're going to ruin the pension plan. Well, the pension plan is 600 times better than it ever was. You know, those old guys are really happy after a while because they all got some increases, one thing we worked on. But Marvin was the most organized, honestly open people that I know. And I appreciate him a lot. I had a lot of respect for him.
Let's see. One of the first meetings you were involved in after you became a player rep was when you and Jim Pagliaroni got stonewalled by the owners. I'm going to meet him later this year.
We got stonewalled a lot in the beginning. I mean, it was just one of why we're meeting, you know. I can't remember the exact topic that we were on, but we were stonewalled 2 or 3 times about it. But that was a New York meeting, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where you went to negotiate, and Louis Kuhn got up and said, "We'll listen, but we have nothing to say."
Billy was good at that. Yeah.
Was it?
We just sort of sat there, you know. So this way it's going to be, Marvin? Yeah. Pretty much. So Marvin used to coach us. I know Tim McCarver and I had a later time. I may be getting ahead of what you're saying, but we went in and he said, "Here's what they're going to offer us. Here's what's going to be, and I want you two guys to really act offended." And McCarver's a great actor anyway, you know. When we came in and they did, just like he said, it's like on cue, it's like he's been reading their notes, you know. And they come in and they do that, and McCarver and I said, "Oh, geez, oh, we can't even believe this, you know, we're going." But we had a lot of that. We were stonewalled 1 year in the winter meetings where we always met with them. They wouldn't meet with us. And that's when we went to Puerto Rico the next year. Said, "You guys meet wherever you want to, we're going here." That's when Bowie came over, and that's when we informed him that he's not our representative. He works for the owners. It's funny, I heard Jerry Reisendorf last night on TV watching on ESPN. White Sox were playing Oakland, I believe. And he even mentioned that the commissioner should be an employee of the owners, should not be considered as someone who's over all baseball. Because he said players have their I know, but they never want to admit it. Bowie never would. Bowie said, "I'm over everybody. I'm the commissioner."
That's what Vincent's doing, yeah.
Oh, I know. He still has the old idea. We even offered him one time. Well, we talked about it. And that was offered. We will pay one half of the cost of the commissioner's office and one half of his salary if we have a 50% vote in hiring and firing him. Then he'd be a true commissioner. Sure. But not a good deal.
I'm not sure if you'd really want that.
I don't think we really did, but just kind of tell him, "Hey, he's not our man."
The people I've talked to generally mentioned Miller's ability as a teacher as one of his outstanding traits. How did he enlighten you?
Oh, 2 or 3 things on how to negotiate, how not to, you know, throw out your main offer right away, and how not to really back somebody in their corner. In other words, we negotiate, we don't kill somebody. You know, we don't want to put them back in their corner where they don't have any other alternatives. You know, we need to always leave somebody an option. That's one thing I learned from them. Never negotiate to the point where somebody doesn't have another offer they can make or an option to what you say. In other words, it can't be for you. This is it, nothing else. You either take it or leave it. Then they got to come out. It's kind of like when you get one of these old pigs down there, hogs down in Tennessee, when you got dogs chasing them, and finally they get cornered. You've been chasing them, and they've got these long teeth, and finally they don't have anywhere else to go because their back's against, so they come out and kill all the dogs. So, you know, you don't do that. And he also, I learned a lot on him on timetables, on not, you know, basically just leaving options. And also, he was totally opposed to strikes. Believe it or not, you know, they said, "Well, Marvin Miller called strikes and stuff." And he didn't really want us to strike. Because he didn't think, I think, the time that we would stay together. It's very difficult because you've got, you know, Mickey Mantle making $100,000, getting a lot of good things. You've got another guy making $7,000 on the other end. Well, Mantle's going to lose a lot more salary than this guy is. And the owner's going to do more for him. So they really worked on those guys. And Marvin wasn't sure we'd stay together. But I learned, Marvin was a good teacher. Marvin taught about negotiating. He taught about rights, workers' rights. We learned about, and trust situations, what we really should have, you know, what we'd had in the past. It's sort of like an education on labor and management and how we had been sort of in the dark ages for a long time. You know, nobody knew what anybody else, how much money you had. When you went in for a negotiation, you went by yourself. It was either take it or leave it. What choice you got, I can play, I can hold out, or I can quit. Or hope maybe get traded somewhere along the line. You had nothing. And we've gotten to the point now where the players, the balance toward the players is pretty good.
Leonard Coppett told me that one reason that the players stayed in the dark ages so long, to use that phrase, is that the men of that generation, and the generation ahead of you, and you probably also as well, were raised to believe that the boss is the boss.
Mm-hmm.
And the boss wants to give you the worst of it. Well, that's
sure.
just
it's baseball.
That's yeah, just part of life. And Miller tried to erase that.
That's right.
Myth.
He said you guys have some rights. He said even the fact that he negotiated for a lot of years, he's an intelligent man, and he could throw in some things that had happened to other labor groups in the past and what they had achieved. And the fact that baseball was not going to go down the tube. He was a good leader. And he was not a guy who wanted to ruin baseball. He thought he had some good ideas that both sides could really, you know, do. And I think history's borne that out, man. You know, baseball makes more money now than ever before. Some of them are crying wolf again, you know. And we keep hearing salary cap and no more arbitration. They think that arbitration is the worst thing that ever happened in baseball. You know, of course, it's been great for players.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it's going to end, but Marvin saw a lot of this, and it's happened because of him, and I hope the players realize that. It's not because of what a lot of us did as older players. It's been basically his vision and his leadership that caused it.
In the 1968 basic agreement, the first basic agreement, did he see that as a big breakthrough or as a stepping stone for further?
I think it's a stepping stone.
Did he downplay the...
No, not necessarily. He knew we needed an agreement. You know, there were things that had been implied. All-star money went toward the pension plan and whatever, and the owners made a big thing saying that after the basic agreement that we'd given up the all-star proceeds to go to the pension plan, you know, or whatever. Not necessarily true. You know, it became a moot point when they were had to fund it at a certain level where it came from, you know, at that point you didn't care anymore. But Marvin knew that there were other things that were coming, and I say stepping stone quickly on that, but although we did hammer that thing out, it took a long time to really get that basic. Today with Jerry Moses at the old timer, and he said that, matter of fact, that might be, no, that's not him, that's the shortstop standing here, anyway, Jerry said that he really went off his whacker after that, pretty bad. He was an outpatient after that, but he said after he did that, he said the next game he played, he was standing at first base here while the guys were trying to throw the ball around the infield, his glove under his arm like he's swinging a bat. And he said he's always a little hyper, you know. And boy, what a day.
How did that folly floater come about?
I need another pitch. I tried to throw a screwball for years. I have little hands. I have no able to do that, and I tried, and I thought if I had another pitch, I could start, so I kept working on that, and I watched Louis Tiant, and Louis would go through these gyrations, turn his back, legs up in the air, and then come through and then throw either a big curve or a change or maybe even a fastball. It was kind of a hesitation in there, so I started trying to work on that, and anyway, it evolved into thinking, you know, I've tried to hit a slow pitch softball, and I can't hit it very well. If you're used to baseball, it's hard to hit a softball. So I said, I wonder what would happen if I threw that ball as easy as I could throw it with an arc, and how well they could hit it or not. So I came down like I'm going to throw a real pitch and then stop and, you know, come through. I worked on it in the bullpen. Everybody laughed at it. Next spring, I go to spring training, and I throw it some. I asked Hal one day, I said, can I throw this in the game? He said, well, don't embarrass us or whatever. I said, well, I try not to. I think I'm embarrassing my pitch in a normal way every now and then, but I'll try to do it, so I threw it. And everybody got a kick out of it, you know, and the guy didn't hit it, so I threw it in batting practice. I mean, I'd work on BP, some of the guys want to hit it. I hit top of the cage by half the time. anyway, it evolved into that, and I said, Ralph, what do you think? He said, well, let's don't throw it, you know. And Lee McPhail came down. He said, we probably better not. They may accuse us of making farce out of the game. You know? I said, okay. So we go back that year, and that was 69. We didn't have very good year. And so about a month into the season, we're losing a bunch of games and things. So Hout comes to me, and he says, maybe we could throw that pitcher, you know, in a certain time. I said, okay. So they bring me in a game, and only threw it when we were behind. I never threw it to somebody having a bad year or a rookie unless he was having a real good year. So anyway, I come in the game, and I throw it, and the people loved it. And so then they kept telling me, you know, so they brought me in some games. I know late in the game I threw that doggone pitch up there, and the fans would start chanting. And when I come in, Bobby Floater. And it made me nervous. I didn't really like throw it that much, but it was fun. But I still was nervous that somebody might jack that thing one of these days all the way out of the stadium, you know, then it would be. But nobody did. They had all singles.
Took a long time for Rip Sewell to give one up.
Yeah.
Really an imitation of that pitch.
Gave it up to the big boy, didn't he?
Yes.
But no, I had five singles off of it. That's all I gave up, you know, and one of those was a bunt that Munson ran over me that Tony Conigliaro bunted, and I'm fielding the ball. Munson runs in because he knocked me head over his.
And they wouldn't let you throw it in the National League?
Got me indication. I went to spring training, and I pitched in. We were playing in Phoenix. Somebody who went back, it was in the big park in spring training, and I National League umpire, and we're playing somebody, and I came up and threw it. And before the pitch even got there, the ump comes out behind a plate guy named Landis. Uh-huh. And he says, that's an illegal pitch. This is no halfway league like the other league. I said, okay. And my manager, Charlie Fox, is sitting over there. He doesn't move, you know, or anything. So I says, okay.
Next case.
So I won't throw it. But what I did, the last game I pitched in, we were playing the Giants in Candlestick when I was with the Cubs, and I threw it.
So I don't care.
Well, it's a pitcher, not I didn't care about the Leo at that point. I'm going to throw this sucker. I lobbed it up there, and it was Kenny Henderson, who had been my teammate. He didn't swing it right down the line. He should have swung. He let it go. He called it no pitch.
Called it no pitch. Yeah. Because of the hesitation?
Right. They say it was, but I really didn't hesitate that much. When I planted my leg, I kept my arm going. So it wasn't like
your body stopped.
Yeah, body stopped, which is a lot of guys throw when their body stops and their arm comes around. And I couldn't do it with a man on because you could steal on it real easily if I did it. Plus, that might be, you know, they consider that.
Could be a bomb.
Yeah. So I never threw a man on base. But that's how it started, and it had a lot of fun. And the Yankees liked it because it kind of took the fans' minds off of losing sometimes. When I did that one right there, McDowell had a two-hitter going against us. It was in the ninth inning. I mean, you'd beat us to death. We had 50,000 people there.
Go home talking about that pitch.
Yeah, and they all cheered. And I had to come back out, do a standing O, you know, for everybody for throwing one stupid pitch. You know, we're getting beat like 6-0. McDowell looks at me before he's on the mound next thing, took all my thunder. But, no, it was good.
Where'd the name come from?
My wife named it. She's an English major, much more intelligent than me. She said it needed to be an alliteration so it would be catchy. And I said, what do you mean alliteration? So anyway, so we decided that folly would be like Seward's folly, you know, where you fought Alaska. It looked like a mistake, but it wasn't. That's what this looked like. First time I threw it to Frank Howard, you know, he's standing for a big prank. And as soon as I dropped and threw, he backed up and said, time. He saw him time out with him. He thought I slipped, you know, or something. He didn't know. He'd never seen it before. And he's calling time out to the umpire, but it was funny. But so the folly, although it didn't, and floater because it floated. And that's in the name. Caught, you know.
The alliteration did it.
Yeah, the alliteration. It's a non-alliteration. I have education. No.
When Miller came in, he was brought in because of his expertise in pensions. Did the players have reason to believe that the owners were enacting properly and administering the pension fund?
No. We were totally, like you're talking about, we were the boss mentality. Plus a lot of players, like myself, had no interest whatsoever in pension. We're young. We just started. We were in the big leagues. We've been seeing this on TV. We read about it. We thought about this, what you want to do your whole life. And I'm in New York with the Yankees, which is really the place to be at that time. And we didn't think about pension plans. Now, some of the older guys may have, But most of us didn't care much about pension plans, so consequently we had never looked at it. And to bring Marvin in, that was one of the things, you know, and we didn't understand because we thought Judge Cannon was okay.
That's how dark the ages were.
He's a nice guy, you know, and he's talking about the integrity of baseball, which is good. But no, we really didn't. That was an education process, too, for all of us, you know. We'd never gotten things from Cannon, whatever. Miller would send us information sheets and talk to us about with knowledge, you know, of what we were capable of, what the pension plan was, how we'd been getting ripped off on other things. So it was an education process again, but in the beginning it wasn't important. Very few of us thought it was important.
By September of 68, when he came around and talked to the individual clubs about the impasse over the pension negotiations, were people by then more receptive to the idea that we've got to do something now?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. The majority of them were. There were some that weren't. I really felt good about our team because they did, and I really felt good about Mickey Mantle because he wasn't going to play anymore. But at that time, he hadn't told management whatever. And when I called him when he was at home, and he told me, and I asked him if he would not make that announcement until after all this was over with and still stay with us on it, and he did. And I didn't think he would. I wasn't sure he would do it because, you know, he was a guy that I'm sure they pay money to come back to spring training and all that, and I'm sure he wouldn't want to risk not having that. Well, you can look back now and see that they'd be out of their skull not to bring back the superhero because of this type of thing. And he did, and he kind of went out with it, so to speak. And we were together. We didn't have anybody that broke ranks with the Yankees. There were some clubs that were going to struggle a little bit, but we knew it was going to be tough. But when Marvin talked about it, it was really a time of decision because our careers are so short that you hate to give any part of it up. And you thought it might happen.
Late in 68, when the possibility was first broached of the mass holdout and the boycott, did you really think it would come to that?
No. In the beginning, the longer we went, I thought it started getting pretty grim. And but again, we still had a lot of that boss mentality. That hadn't changed that much. I mean, it was we were losing it a little bit, but it was still a big part of it. And you're thinking, well, you know, when those guys say they're not going to do something, you know, and we start thinking, we wonder whether we're doing the right thing or not. And that's where Marvin and his steadying influence came, you know, really came across well with all of us. And it's sort of like, well, we may have to do this. You know, we may have to not play. And, wow, boy, that's a shock because most of us had bills for credit. You know, we didn't make it. And without playing, without having any income, it's not like today's player where most of them have quite a few dollars. We're counting on that money to pay bills. And that made it very tough too.
In August of 68, you wrote a letter to the Sporting News. And I have my copy of it here. I find it remarkable, not only for its content, but simply the fact that you elected to challenge their editorial policy. That was, I